You're listening to Beyond Bourbon Street, an insider's guide to New Orleans. Beyond Bourbon Street is the podcast where we explore the food, music, culture, places, and people that make New Orleans unique. Whether you are planning a trip, living in New Orleans, or simply wanting a taste of the Crescent City from wherever you are, you've come to the right place. And now, your host, Mark Bologna.
Hey y'all, this is Mark. Welcome to episode 188. Today's episode is about the history of New Orleans' successes and failures when it comes to draining the city of New Orleans of water, fighting floods, rising tides, and more. The last show was a long-awaited and requested interview with my mom. We discussed raising kids and grandkids in New Orleans, surviving hurricanes Betsy and Katrina, and a whole lot more. If you missed it, go back and give it a listen. I think you'll enjoy it. Before we jump into today's topic, let me talk about the people that make this show possible. Support comes from the Historic New Orleans Collection, the city's premier history museum located at 520 Royal Street in the heart of the French Quarter. Check out their online publication called First Draft. It's a combination blog and online exhibition space at hnoc.org/firstdraft. Through November 5th, 2023, you can check out their exhibit about the women's right to vote titled Yet She Is Advancing. We actually did an episode a couple of episodes back about that with the curator of that exhibit. It's really terrific. The 19th Amendment granted American women the right to vote, but in 1920, of course, but Louisiana effectively disenfranchised black women. As many white women started going to the polls and increasing their participation in segregation-era New Orleans, African-American women continued to fight for access to the ballot. From everything from paying their poll taxes to organizing voter registration drives, they were challenged as their status as second-class citizens up to and through the passage of the Voting Rights Act in 1965. The exhibit tells a decades-long story through objects, images, artifacts, interactive displays, and more. As always, the Historic New Orleans Collection's free. It somehow still continues to fly under the radar, but you ought to check it out. Go to hnoc.org/visit to plan your trip. The most frequent questions I get are about moving to New Orleans. If you're ready to make the move, you need a good realtor, and that's where Liz Wood comes in. Let Liz and her team over at Liz Wood Realty help you find the right place. She can help whether you plan to rent or purchase. Look, New Orleans is a terrific city, but choosing the neighborhood that's the best fit for you can be overwhelming. Liz somehow makes that process fun and easy. Reach out to Liz at lizwoodrealty.com and make your dream of living in New Orleans a reality. Many, many members of our community have done just that, and they're thrilled with their new homes. You will be too. The other thing that really sets Liz apart is that she really takes an active role in trying to build a community. So once you come to New Orleans, she does a lot of events and get-togethers to try to make you part of that community so that you're not only coming to a new place, but you are coming into a community. So again, reach out to Liz when you're ready. And finally, before we jump in, where you're looking for a home to purchase, you're probably going to need to secure financing. Reach out to Tommy Manzella at Gulf Coast Mortgage and let him help you get everything in place. That's what we did on a refi a couple years ago, and it went as smooth as could be. We went through the process again when we were looking for a new home, and it was just as easy. Reach out to Tommy Manzella at gulfbank.com/mortgage, and I'll put links to all this in the show notes. All right, now on to the main show. My guest today is the author of more than a dozen books about New Orleans. He's a professor at Tulane University and an intense researcher about the history of all things New Orleans, told through the lens of geography across time and history. Welcome back to the podcast, Richard Campanella. How are you?
All right. Thank you very much.
It's been a couple years. You've written a couple books since then. It seemed like it was a good time to come back and chat with you.
Yep.
As we were talking just before we came on air, so Richard's newest book, Draining New Orleans, The 300-Year Quest to Dewater the Crescent City, goes into a lot of detail. We're not going to go into all that detail today. I want to kind of whet your appetite and get you to pick up a copy of the book. But what caused you to take on this topic, Richard?
Drainage in this city is the single most consistent and fundamental theme in everything that I personally have researched about the historical and present-day geography of the metropolitan area, which I've been doing for the better part of 30 years now.
Yeah, I was really, you know, as I was reading this book, I was thinking back about some of your other books, and drainage comes up in those other books in various different ways.
I would go so far to say this. If you compare the a map of this city from 200 years ago, it limned a crescent, and thus the nickname. Mm-hmm. Compare that same footprint to today, and it's a spread eagle-shaped metropolis that's 20 miles west to east and about 10 miles north to south. Subtract one from the other, and the difference was enabled by drainage. That's how intrinsic and fundamental it is to the story.
Yeah, it's pretty amazing. And it also seems that, just like in your book about the 300 years of the city of New Orleans, you talk about an accidental city and where it was placed. It seems like
that's actually not my term, accident. Okay. That's Larry Powell.
Larry, thank you. It seems that from the very beginning, the founders had their eye on drainage. That was absolutely fundamental. They came to a place that was boggy and swampy, and even the original footprint of the French Quarter, they had to think about drainage from the beginning.
Yep. And the way they did it was gravity. There was no mechanized means. There were no pumps. Steam power was a century in the future. And so the only way they could move water off land and make that land dry enough for urbanization was to use the very, very slight but very important topography that we do have, which goes from, at that time, at most about 10 feet above sea level to about 2 or 3 feet above sea level, about a mile and a half away. And through very careful engineering, which is easier on paper than in operations, and therein lied the problem, they were able to, what I call the ditch and gravity era of the drainage of New Orleans, digging intricate ditches around each of the aisles or blocks in the French Quarter and steering the water to the back swamp.
And as you talk about in the book, that really laid the foundation for decisions that would be made even today. Once they made that decision, it sort of set in motion a whole lot of other things.
Well, one of the themes in this book is a phenomenon called path dependency, which is used by geographers and economists to describe how decisions made at one point restrict the range of future decisions that can be made. And I'll give you, now there's good path dependency and there's bad path dependency. For example, standard gauge and railroads, okay? When railroads were first coming about in the 1820s, 30s, 40s, almost every line used a different distance between their tracks, which means they couldn't connect them. Mm-hmm. So a decision was made to all agree upon, was it 4 feet, 6 inches, or something like 8.5? And that was a good standardization that established a path. They became dependent on it, and now all these trains could go back and forth. Well, what often happens, however, is that a decision is made based on the understandings and the values and the priorities of the era, which in fact proved to be faulty later on. But because we already went so far down that path, it becomes that much more expensive to retrace our steps, go backwards, make a better decision, and then restart. And a lot of our drainage story plays out exactly along those lines, that decisions are made, we start building expensive infrastructure, putting in pumps locations, and then we realize, oh, you know what? We should have done this differently, but you know what? We've sunk so much cost in this that it's easier because this is an operational task. We have to worry about the thunderstorm this afternoon. It's not an academic problem. It's easier to continue that present decision into tomorrow rather than taking all the time and money to back up and get it right from start.
And that's a theme we'll hit on in the discussion, but that's a theme that comes up over and over in your book, right? Yep. Those initial decisions impact even what we do today.
They sure do. If I may say, we're on Howard Avenue and I'm looking down on this very wide avenue. And the reason why that is wide is because Bartholomew Lafon, in laying out the Lower Garden District in 1806, 1810, used ditches and gravity to steer the water off what we now call the Coliseum Square area to the back swamp. That water would go down Melpomene along St. Charles Avenue, which was called Naiads at the time, the water nymphs, and then loop around Tivoli Circle, later Lee Circle, now Harmony Circle, and go down Howard Avenue. And that's why Howard Avenue is laid out so widely.
Interesting. One point, just a definition, if you will, a word that you use throughout the book that I think would be helpful for people is you use the word polder.
Polder.
Could you explain what that is?
Polder is a Dutch word that means an urban hydrological sub-basin. And if that's not helpful enough, think of it as a bathtub, okay? Imagine the very slight topography in a city and the rain falls and you have a slightly higher ridge around an area, a particular neighborhood, and all the water that falls therein accumulates at the bottom of that. That mm-hmm. is a polder. If I may, let me drop a couple of other definitions down
sure.
because they're very relevant. I make a distinction between, not really, it's kind of a gradation between the term reclamation and term drainage. Mm-hmm. Now, the way we use drainage, it could mean all of the above or it could be something very specific. So in a very broad sense, drainage simply means the removal of water. And it could be used in everything from medicine to civil engineering. When I use the term reclamation, what it implies is the removal of standing water, okay, so actual clear water that either is standing on top of the land, meaning a swamp. If it is forested, it is a swamp. If it's a grasslands, it's a marsh. Or standing in a place like Lake Pontchartrain or the Mississippi River. The lakefront was reclaimed in the early 1920s, and that's why we have UNO, all those lake neighborhoods there. Mm-hmm. The Batcher formed in the early 1800s off Chapatula Street, and that converted open water to land. So that's reclamation. Now, drainage encompasses that, but it goes even further. So reclamation would have been the process by which the swamp water was removed from the lowlands of what is now Metairie and Lakeview and eastern New Orleans and Gentilly. But it was only on the installation of subsurface drainage apparatus, storm drains, underground pipes, culverts leading to pump stations, that the actual soil water is drawn down even further. And it's only then that in an environment like this, you're able to actually urbanize. And that made a big difference, that mm-hmm. distinction between initial reclamation and then later subsurface drainage, which enabled the neighborhoods we have today.
And you talk in your book about that the very earliest days were about drainage, just getting the water out that might come through crevasses or might just come over topping the levees. But then fairly quickly in our history, we moved to reclamation, and that's really tied to economics, right?
Well, it's tied to economics. There's demand for land. Reclaimed land suddenly becomes valuable. So if you buy it on the cheap when it's still swamp, and then you get the apparatus in there to drain it, then you sell it on dear, and you could make a profit. But there was another motivation here, and that was public health. The perception at that time, and I can't overemphasize how powerful this was, that swamps, marshes, and wetlands produce disease. It was called miasmatic theory, miasma coming from a Greek and Latin word meaning decomposition. Based on ancient notions of medicine, a lot of it was about fluids and bodily fluids. People spoke of the four humors mm-hmm. in a body, meaning blood and saliva and phlegm and things like this. And so there was a notion that when these fluids and this moisture in the body was out of whack with each other, was imbalanced, that insalubrity came out of that. Mm-hmm. And so remember, we're talking about Europeans here. So when they come to a subtropical environment or a tropical environment, and they use the word torrid, a very revealing yeah. imperialistic term, torrid, to describe these environments, they perceived these swamps and wetlands to be out of balance. And from them, they perceived these vaporous gases that they call miasmas to cause disease, and hence malaria, bad air, and dengue and yellow fever. And so the imperative to drain these swamps was in part for real estate value and urban expansion, but it was also to stop epidemics like the 1853 yellow fever epidemic, which killed at least 10,000 people and was a major impetus for pushing ahead, this being now in the age of steam uh-huh. engines that could be used for drainage, in 1854, 1855.
And that kind of leads me to, throughout the book, and again, we're not going to cover all of them because I want you to read the book, but you talk about this idea of these heroes that pop up, and there are, gosh, you probably mentioned two dozen, maybe more, because of their importance at a moment in time. You know, right at the beginning, you had Pogger, and then you mentioned Lafon as he built out the kind of new Orleans and what we now think of today as the back of the CBD and the Garden District. You start off your book with a prologue about sort of this scene right around Mardi Gras in 1915 and one of the heroes who happens to be named Hero. Can you talk just a little bit about that?
It's an incredible moment. And I actually use the term kings.
Kings, yes.
And it so happened that The man that everyone literally called the drainage king, capital D, capital K, was George Hero. And I mean, you can't make this up. And all you have to do is read the first page of the prologue and you will get a sense immediately that my original title for this book was The Drainage Kings.
Yes.
And I use that theme throughout, playing on the notion of this being the only American state named for a French king, the Bourbon heritage mm-hmm. of this, and I don't mean the street, of the society, and the carnival royalty of the use of king and queen and how deeply respected that is in local society, that I use the term drainage kings to identify many of these leaders of the move to drain the city. A lot of them came from the elite class. Many of them were kings, were
sure.
carnival kings. And so we have this figure, George Hero, who's a really remarkable character. I won't go into too much detail, but among many other things, he figured out rather handily at the right time and place, this is in the early 19-teens, on creating drainage districts, this new kind of little legal invention. And it coincided right around the time of A. Baldwin Wood and the wood screw pumps. And he figured out how to get together all of these landowners in three parishes on the West Bank and install these huge pumping stations, some of them the largest in the world. And he was going to drain the West Bank in a matter of hours. And because this is New Orleans, he was going to do it New Orleans style. So they arranged this elaborate parade on the Saturday before Mardi Gras in 1915. And there were bands and there was parades and fancy cars and these heralds with the sign H-E-R-O, George Hero, the Drainage King. And they go downtown and they get on a riverboat and a yacht, and they have this big ceremony way in the back swamp about to be drained of Jefferson Parish. And they arrange for President Woodrow Wilson to press a button in the Oval Office and activate the pumps. And I'll let the reader see what happened from there.
Good. I'm glad you're leaving them hanging. It's a real catchy prologue that just pulls you in immediately. I think it's an amazing kind of introduction to it.
And that's him on the cover, by the way.
Oh, is it?
Yeah.
Okay, I didn't realize that. So yeah, everybody all dressed up.
His grandson is still alive in the city. He's 95 years
really?
Old. His grandson.
Wow. Yeah, it's a good story. The prologue alone is worth it because it really does sort of suck you in. And you can picture this carnival atmosphere, right? Certainly knew the moment and knew the city even back then.
And everyone agreed with it. Every element of society, from top to bottom, rich, poor, black and white, everyone agreed that this was a major victory over a longtime enemy of which everyone could be proud.
And this gets back to your initial discussion about decisions were made in the 1700s. Here we are, we jump to the 1915s, and I'm going to take you back just a couple decades before that in a moment, but it's decision upon decision upon decision. Yep. So we've made this decision about using gravity and how we're going to outflow and where we're going to put the actual pumps. But one of the things that really comes into play there is the 1890s.
Yep.
And some decisions
pivotally
there and a plan that was laid
right.
out. So if you could discuss that just a little bit for people.
Well, there was another bad epidemic in 1878, and that really, really pushed drainage front and center to the public attention. And everyone had an opinion. Everyone was coming up with plans. You look at the letters to the editor, you know, these armchair engineers, well, I think we ought to put this. And so it was a case, this is a progressive era. So, you know, informed, engaged citizens are really pushing their leaders to not just drain the city, but also sewerage, potable water systems. They all come out of this era. Playgrounds, urban beautification, parks, things like this. So, Drainage Advisory Board is established to do research on this in 1893. They finally get the charge, they get revenue, and they start doing high-end topographic mapping because there were no reliable maps here. So, what eventually becomes a Sewage and Water Board, these expert engineers, most of them local, come together and start actually designing the system. And the big decision, now I should say, this is the moment when they're abandoning the gravitational systems. Uh-huh. In fact, there had been steam pumps that were already fighting gravity and going full out with the use of enormous pumps to reclaim and then subsurface drain, which then would require that the pumps lift the water up and over the levees and into the outfall, that is the destination. So the question became, where is the outfall? Now, listeners familiar with the city might immediately say, oh, it's Lake Pontchartrain. Don't we eject our water into Lake Pontchartrain? Their decision, and they made it very carefully and documented their rationale very carefully, was to go to Lake Bourne. Mm-hmm. And you could read the details in the book, but they were going to take all, imagine the Uptown Bowl, okay, everything from the French Quarter all the way to Carrollton, that kind of amphitheater of topography, all the water falling in there naturally would drain out Bayou St. John. So they were going to put in this big mega canal, they called it the Main Canal, beneath Broad and Florida Avenue, and they were going to put pumps along there to mobilize and push the water without lifting it straight eastward to connect with Bayou Bienvenue, which ejects and discharges into Lake Bourne. And the reasoning at the time was compelling. When they did what today we would call a cost-benefit analysis, and you read it and you're like, yeah, you know what? That makes sense. Now, later on, for complicated reasons, by the 1920s, that didn't work anymore, and you could read the details. But very gradually and in a very kind of ad hoc, never one decisive moment, most of the water was instead shifted to go northward to Lake Pontchartrain instead of eastward to Lake Bourne. But you know what? Because of path dependency, the pumps were already committed, big, enormous, heavy objects, the hearts of the system, to the broad Florida corridor. And that eventually proved to be a terrible mistake. But again, when the decision was first made, it was logical. It made sense at the time.
Sure. And part of that context was you had West End Park and you had Milneyburg and you had Spanish Fort. So these were destinations, right? You got to think back in time. Those were destinations from the city. I mean, it's a 10-minute drive today, but it wasn't then. And so those were really, really popular places. And so that certainly came into play. There was a lot of...
It sure did.
You get into detail in the book. I'll save it for people to read. But this decision about going into Lake Pontchartrain versus somewhere else was a big deal because it had economic impact. It had a lot of impact.
To a degree that really surprised me, they cared about water pollution.
Right.
They were concerned about polluting the waters along popular beaches, whereas if you went eastward with Lake Bourne, there was a whole lot less population out there. There was also more of a hydraulic drop there, so you have more of a flushing motion. Mm-hmm. And so let me come full circle and just briefly explain why that became so much of a problem. And I should say this book is not a triumphalist take on drainage. It recounts the triumphalist feeling at the time, but there is a tragic counterpart to this. What they didn't fully realize they were doing, or at least didn't appreciate, was that by removing the water component from the soil, they are robbing it of a major portion of its volume. Okay, our soils here, deltaic soils, have exactly five components of it: sand, silt, clay, water, and organic matter. By removing the water, you're opening up cavities. That dryness oxidizes the organic matter, that opens up more cavities. Into those spaces, the very fine alluvium, sand, silt, and clay particles settle, compact, and drop below sea level. And that is the other half of this story. And that's the tragedy here. They thought they were saving the city. In fact, they were sinking the city. So as the city is sinking, the pumps are married to the middle of the city because they were supposed to go to Bourne. And so the mechanisms for lifting the water are in the middle of a sinking city. Then that means that the canals through which that water is being pushed are going to be rising above where people's heads are.
Right.
Literally, the water in the outfall canals in Lakeview and Gentilly are above people's houses from cradle to grave. They're living with that water above the house. And we all know what happened during Katrina.
Yep.
So had the Bourne decision not been made, and the decision initially was to push to Pontchartrain, presumably the pumps would have been located right at the lake perimeter. And so you dig your outfall canals downhill, let gravity bring the water right to the brink of the city, and then the pumps do the lifting and the ejecting at the last minute instead of miles.
Well, and two things hit me very early on in your book. One, almost from the first chapter, I started thinking about Katrina. and we'll get to that. But the second was, you have mentioned many times before that it's a misnomer when people say New Orleans is below sea level. At one time, almost all of New Orleans was actually above sea level.
Every bit.
And even today, I think 50% is above sea level.
It's 50%, that is correct.
And this whole idea of using gravity and those decisions as we reclaim that land, it sunk it. It did cause it to sink.
Well, the gravity is what we want to use. It's this sort of subverted pushing water uphill that we found ourselves having to do once we abandoned gravity and started using all too successful mechanized means.
Now, one of the things I did want to highlight, and again, I don't want to talk about all the people you mentioned, but you mentioned the wood screw in passing.
Yeah.
And, you know, maybe that ended up being faulty, not the screw itself, but the pump itself. But if you could just talk a little bit about
the screw. Well, first of all, the mechanism itself was not faulty at all. It's
right.
Brilliant engineering.
It's still in use.
It's still in use, and there's a whole bunch of them. A. Baldwin Wood is a locally born, 1879. He was the descendant of some prominent leaders from colonial times, prominent family. Really just a prodigy engineer. He was in the very first engineering class at Tulane after they moved uptown.
Right.
And graduated in 1899 at 20 years old and went straight to work for what became the Sewage and Water Board and spent the next 57 years as a humble civil servant. Hmm. And his inventions were absolutely incredible. They really start around 1906. And his major contribution was replacing these sloppy sort of vertical displacement pumps. And I compare, just to use an analogy here, the pumps that were in place at the time, they lifted water through vertical displacement and then just spilled it out into this chamber, just flopping out like this. And then from there, gravity took it out to the lake. What Wood did was turn that into this this internal turbine impeller that it is above the grade within the station. So workers, if they needed to repair it, don't have to go down into this well. And it increased the capacity and the speed multiple times so that instead of like a helicopter, it's like a jet engine.
Hmm.
And it just shot the water out. And he also invented these rakes that remove debris. And you can see them when you go by the big pumping stations.
Right.
There's these big metal vertical racks with these rakes that just constantly pull water hyacinth, garbage, things like that.
Mm-hmm.
And they dump it out and then someone comes along and cleans it away. And so between that and a number of other mechanisms, Wood made an existing system probably about 10 to 15 times more efficient. And so he is regarded as a real hero to this day in the Sewage and Water Board. He was an amazing man. And I don't want to fault him in any way, shape, or form, except to say that increased efficiency brought all the more subsidence.
Sure.
And the lure and temptation that we don't have to worry about topography and water anymore. We could live anywhere we want. And so what you see after these pumps are installed is that much more of the residential development of these areas, even as they're sinking further below sea level.
And that's a theme throughout your book, that there are these titans that dedicate their lives to this. They come up with these incredible inventions, but it's all sort of on this faulty decision-making, faulty through today's eyes, right?
It's very important to point
out. At the time, it made sense.
Yep.
And as you said, there was great debate. There was a lot of thought put into this, but it was fundamentally upon what we now would see as a flawed decision. But it spurred this growth, and you go into in great detail your book all kinds of neighborhoods that are iconic New Orleans neighborhoods today that wouldn't have existed without that.
Yep.
Now there's a question of should they exist or should they have existed because of that, right? I want to jump forward, but before we do, I gotta pay some bills real quick, Richard. Longtime listeners probably remember the crew over at Two Chicks Walking Tours. They're the ones that operate intentionally small tours. The city will allow you to go out on a tour with up to 28 people, but Two Chicks limits tours to 14 people, and if you sign up and you're the only one scheduled that day, they'll take you out on a personal tour. Their experiences are focused on the Garden District and the French Quarter neighborhoods. They also produce private curated walks for groups from 1 to 200 if you want to do that. The team is all female-led, but they do have one rooster strutting around, and there are tour guides from before the lockdown still on staff. They're constantly working to improve their knowledge. They are some of the best tours in the city, so be sure to check them out. You can find out more at twochickswalkingtours.com. We'll put a link link in the show notes. And then the last one I want to mention before we jump back into the discussion is our newest sponsor called All the Bitter. They make 100% alcohol-free bitters using organic ingredients. They've won 15 awards from major spirit competitions, and they can be used in both alcohol and non-alcohol-based concoctions. Richard and I both have young children, and so we've used them at home on vanilla ice cream. It's a lot of fun for the kids, and they're completely alcohol-free, so that's fun. I've used them in old fashions with alcohol, but they're great if you are or you go alcohol-free. They have four main bitters now, and a couple experimental ones on the way. The ones I have are the New Orleans, which is inspired by Angostura and Peychaud's, as well as orange, lavender, and aromatic. Place your order at allthebitters.com and use the code BB15 to get 15% off your order. So I want to jump back now, and I want to jump us forward, if we could. So these decisions you mentioned, you know, if the pumps had only been placed at the end of the outfall canals, it would have made a world of difference. And now I'm going to jump way far forward, and it turns out today, that's what we have. We have pumps to some degree, right?
Yeah, but they're after not, Katrina, they're not, but they're not truly
right. They're more like locks, I guess.
Well, they're designed, first of all, let me just set up here. The pumps that we're talking about here were installed after Katrina to serve two purposes. There are closable gates to keep, as a hurricane is approaching, to keep outside water from coming in those outfall canals. Once you close the gates, you have the problem of how do you eject the rainfall that is falling during a hurricane within the city. And so these pumps we're talking about here are bypass pumps that when the gate is closed, go around them and eject the water. But they're only running during as hurricanes Trent are approaching
storms.
Or hitting.
Yeah.
So it's really not part of the operational drainage system for the other 99.9% of the year.
And as we were getting to that, you know, you get into the 1900s, as you talked about, we started to get into this situation of named storms that weren't hurricanes, but we had these floods and multiple days, right?
Yeah, the date storms.
The date storms.
This phenomenon of the date storms. It's funny that they don't have a name. The phenomena doesn't have a name. So in the book, I call them the rise of the date storms. And by a date storm, I mean, and all the locals will understand this, August 5th, May 8th, 1995, August 5th, 2017, when you have these, they're really flash floods. They're extremely intense downpours that overwhelm the capacity of the drainage system to remove the water, sometimes by an order of magnitude. And because they don't have names, people remember them by their dates. And that is our big challenge now, these flash in super intense date storms. Now, it so happens we have not had one. The last one that I remember was in July of 2019. We've had our share of downpours, but not really the knee-deep, destroyed car sort of flooding in a while. But we had a spate of them in 17, 18, and 19, and that really pushed forward some of the sustainable urban water management ideas that we're talking about now.
Yeah. The other thing, and I just kind of want you to skim on this because I think this is fascinating reading. There were two other decisions that were made over time. One was the Industrial Canal, and the second is what we call locally the Mr. Go. And those decisions to put those bodies of water had at their basis, I think, commerce. But both of them proved to be fatalistic when you led up to Katrina.
Yep.
Could you just maybe whet people's appetite a little bit about that?
Right. Let's start with the Industrial Canal. The idea, the dream of connecting river and lake, you could trace all the way back to the 1720s. And there were various attempts to kind of do most of it, like the New Basin Canal. But it wasn't until the 1910s that all the factors aligned. The Port of New Orleans was pushing for it. And the real impetus was, I mean, it's a pretty shallow lake. It's a bay. Yeah. You're not going to get deep draft vessels out there. But in creating this inner harbor, you're opening up all of this leasable space across what was formerly Back Swamp in the Ninth Ward that you can now lease out to value-added industries, to shipbuilders. And so that was the main impetus. And so it was agreed upon 1914. It was dug 1918 and opened in 1923. And one of the effects it had is it subverted the plan to push the drainage water eastward. Right. I mean, it just blocks it right.
Right.
Now, you might think, well, can't you just dump that water right into the canal? Well, not really, because one of the ideas of the canal was that it would had a fixed stage as opposed to the river going up and down. So if you're pumping tens of thousands of cubic feet of outfall into that, you know, that's a problem. And so what was built was this, what the press called this underground river. This is the heroic age of civil engineering. Right. Everything was possible and there weren't any environmental impact statements. And so what the underground river was this siphon to take the outfall from the drainage system under the industrial canal. This is in the rear of the lower Ninth Ward, and then connected up with Bayou Bienvenue. Well, it wasn't big enough. It had capacity problems. It clogged. And that was the main problem that forced the rerouting of the outfall in little bits and pieces over the 1920s to go to Lake Pontchartrain instead of Lake Bourne. Now let's talk about the MRGO. There has been, I think I call it a demonic imp on the shoulders of port leaders and the shipping industry in the city going back into the 1800s, whispering, if you just cut a seaway across, you could get to the, you could connect New Orleans to the Gulf faster, better, cheaper. And there are just 3, 4, 5 on the West Bank, on the East Bank, proposals to do exactly this. The West Bank almost got the MRGO.
Yeah.
And in their mind, failed. We should be so lucky.
Right.
And instead, eventually in the 1950s, in the late 50s, it was decided to go what they called the Alexander Seaway, and eventually is under construction from 1958 and largely dug by the time Betsy hits. People think, oh, the MRGO opened in 1968. Yeah, it fully opened, but it took 10 years to build. And I could show you aerial photos from 1964. It's mostly in place. And that is what allowed Betsy's surge to be so bad in the lower Ninth Ward. It's fully opened in 1968, and almost immediately it starts becoming disappointing. And I should mention, this is for ocean-going traffic. This is deep draft. This is to essentially move the Port of New Orleans off the Mississippi River and move it out to the east, Central Port, they called it. And the main problem was widening. It needed constant, very expensive dredging. And if you're in the shipping industry, you're going to be really cautious about casting your lot and moving all your apparatus, your facilities out there when you're not sure you could depend on this.
Sure.
And so it was always disappointing, and the usage went down and down over the turn of the century. And then Katrina hit, and I think most of your listeners know that the MRGO was the major conduit of Katrina's storm surge. It was unblocked, and that is what sent not all, but, you know, a really disproportionate share of the flood waters that inundated more than a huge portion of the eastern half of the metropolis, and people died as a result.
And so much of your book talks about all these different things that were made and the decisions that were made. And like so many things, even today, the decisions largely fall among people of lower economic statuses or more severely impacted. You think about the Ninth Ward with Katrina and even earlier in Betsy and Camille and all of those things. And you talk about, and I just want to skim this because I really want people to read this part. You talk about there was a moment where we engage with the Dutch, and we have the Dutch dialogues, I think you call them, right? Where there's a moment in time where maybe the city is thinking about, and there's a pioneer, a man that's really pushing this to say, let's go look at what the Netherlands have done and what the Dutch have done and see how we can do that here in New Orleans. And it seems like some things have happened, a little bit in Gentilly, a tiny bit, but there's still that push and pull in the city, even today, that I think that's what comes across in your book, that we go and we study from this part of the world that seems to have mastered this. And we just can't quite make those adjustments.
Well, first of all, the individual you're speaking about is David Wagner, a friend and colleague of mine. He's an architect. The last chapter of the book, the subtitle, of course, is Dewatering New Orleans. The last chapter is Rewatering New Orleans. And David spearheaded the concept based on a post-Katrina junket to the Netherlands. And most people hear the word junket and they think of, basically a free trip to an exotic place and you're supposed to be working. But amazing things came out of this one and perhaps others. And mostly it was to take, you know, traumatized leaders in New Orleans right after Katrina to see the Holy Land, to see the massive barriers and in Category 5 levees now and all this sort of thing of keeping outside water from coming in. And David was with that group, but he was thinking more along the lines of what you do with the water that naturally falls on the landscape, precipitation, okay?
Right.
And so they took these long bus trips across the Netherlands to go see these outlying barriers, and everyone's chatting away on the bus, and David's looking out the window, and what he's watching is how the Dutch handled water on the landscape. So when he came back, he was not all gung-ho about levees and barriers. He wanted to have this parallel other conversation about what we do with the rainwater that falls on it. And what the Dutch do is they keep it on the landscape, okay? Water is intrinsic to a fluvial delta. And so what David spearheaded with the help of a number of other colleagues was what he called Dutch dialogues. And it was exactly that. It was a wonder, you know, we would talk about interdisciplinary, international collaboration, professionals from different societies and different cultures coming across and helping each other. This is like the world's best example. It was beautiful. And so they, you know, these Dutch engineers came over here. This is in 2008, 9, 10. And some of us went over there, exchanged thoughts. And what came out of this was David and others' articulation of what became in 2013, now 10 years ago, the Sustainable Urban Water Management Plan for New Orleans. And in a nutshell, what it means is it reverses or it challenges the notion adopted in the 1890s that water was a problem and we need to eject as much of it as possible. And it reverses that and said, we need to capture as much as possible, store it on the landscape, recharge the groundwater, and every drop you store in scenic retention ponds, and maybe you could make them beautiful, and amenities, is one less drop that you have to leave to the pumps, which are already overcapacitated, to eject. And that's the basic idea of it, capture water on the landscape.
It's a fascinating part of the book because it sort of takes us full circle from the original, let's get rid of the water that's coming in, the problems that happen with the subsistence when you take the water out of the land itself. We jump through again, we're skimming through 300 years here, but you then get to the problems of Katrina, the problems of the Date floods. You know, we still get these kind of micro ones. We haven't had big ones, but we have had certainly in parts of the city. I think Lakeview a year ago or 2 years ago had a problem. And then now there's this tiny project. I'll call it tiny, but it has potential in Gentilly, where we're taking a piece of property that was destroyed during Katrina, and we're trying to implement David's idea, or the idea, one of the ideas that came out of it.
Yeah, and that was donated to the city, I think, for like a 99-year lease for $1 or something like that, by the sisters.
Yeah.
I'd be St. Joseph, I might be wrong. The nuns there, how could you not describe this as a match made in heaven? You know, David has this idea, the nuns have the land there, it's in the right place. I do want to say that if people are looking out, they probably heard of this. I mean, you turn on the radio, you see it on bus billboards, that, you know, capturing water and you know, it's amazing. And people might be looking around and say, well, how come we're still having these flash floods? And the reason is path dependency again. You know, and my students, you know, they said, well, if we know what the solution is, why don't we fix it? And my answer, and I try to be kind of patient because I understand the impatience, is that you cannot undo 100+ years of infrastructure and placemaking and value creation and neighborhood making. You can't just snap your fingers and undo it and, quote, get things right.
Right.
It has to be, you have no, unless you want to, you make a whole lot of enemies and expropriate a whole lot of properties and create a whole lot of animus, you have to do it incrementally.
Yeah.
And that's the beauty of the of the rewatering concept is that it could be done in 101 little pilot projects here and there, and 1,001 little cistern buckets where you're capturing your own rainwater, because every gallon that you keep out of the system is one less gallon of burden to those pumps and outfalls. And if you could pour it on the soil and it goes, recharges the groundwater, all the better.
Well, and for the Dutch dialogues chapter alone, I would say it is worth picking up the book. The book is terrific because of the whole history, but because having lived here or been a part of the community right after Katrina, there were all these radical plans, right? Let's not rebuild neighborhoods, whole neighborhoods, and let's essentially rewater, although that's not quite what they were calling it then. But it was sort of that whole kind of NIMBY thing. Well, not in my backyard, or you're going to expropriate my land. You know, Broadmoor came up, for instance, I remember in one of the plans, and people were like, well, this is a wonderful idea, but who are you to say that you're going to take this away? And of course, a lot of those plans, again, were based on social system and social class, right? And so a lot of them ended up being the proposed plans were, well, let's take away these low-lying, maybe people with lesser incomes or minorities or those sorts of things. But the Dutch Dialogues has this idea of, as you say, take it where we can get it and start it, right? Because everything is worthwhile. We have skimmed over 300 years, and we have done that intentionally. The book is fascinating. Again, if you go through it, I think you have this sense of today. So you think about Katrina and beyond, but really the decisions and Katrina can be traced all the way back. The book is called Draining New Orleans, The 300-Year Quest to Dewater the Crescent City. Richard, where can people pick up the book?
I know it's Octavia Books and many other local bookstores.
I think all the local bookstores.
And the publisher's LSU Press. Very happy to work with them. I've done a number of books, and they're great.
Yeah. So I'll put links to the local bookshops where you can pick it up. I would strongly encourage you to read it. It's a really interesting, as are all of your books. You just pick a theme and have a unique take on the city. But this one is so fundamental to the city and really gave me an understanding of why we're where we are now. These decisions that were made, again, all well-meaning, mostly very well thought out, highly debated, cheered on in many cases, but one decision begat another decision begat another decision. And then you can clearly see the foundation through your book of, as we hit these big storms, the Camilles and the Betsys and then Katrina, the Date floods, you can sort of see as you read the book why these things happen.
It's a story of unforeseen consequences.
Yeah, that's a great way to end it. Thank you, Richard, for taking the time to do this. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
And with that, we're going to turn it over to my girls to close us out.
New episodes are available every other Wednesday. If you're enjoying the podcast, please share it with someone else who loves New Orleans as much as you do. Until next time, laissez le bon temps rouler.
Thanks for listening to the Beyond Bourbon Street podcast. Find us anytime at beyondbourbonst.com.